The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We do have a free for all in Shanghai and the Hong Kong markets, and that's set to continue. But for how long? To what extent? It's just curious to me. It's now ingrained amongst the leveraged and speculative community that central bank monetary policy is in essence paving a new way into a new kind of capitalism. And this is apparently a good thing. I guess I have to register my doubts on that.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. $500 billion lost in the fixed income market. I mean, fixed income, we're talking bonds, we're talking a lot of retired people. It's the only income, the meager little interest that they've been getting in bonds. Now their principal is dropping, and over $500 billion lost in the last couple of weeks in bonds, Dave. Why?
Well, and the interesting thing is it's primarily government bonds. And as an RBS director, head of European credit, said, this is Andrew Roberts from Royal Bank of Scotland, it's pandemonium in the fixed income markets. Everybody's been trying to get out of long duration positions at the same time, but the door is getting smaller. And it gets to that illiquidity issue we've mentioned now weeks ago. It is in this 2-week period where, yes, we've seen close to $500 billion in losses. And you say, well, okay, it's a paper loss. Yes, that is true. It's a paper loss. I think the issue is that people were buying bonds as if they were a sure bet.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's really how they've been sold through the years, is they're a sure bet. But let's face it, Dave, our entire adult lives, the last 40 years or so, have been falling interest rate markets. Of course, bonds are going to look like they're a sure bet.
It's fascinating to me. I think Bloomberg has given this some very good coverage, not only in talking about the pandemonium in the fixed income markets, pointing out that $500 billion in paper losses have been accrued in a 2-week period, but also to point out kind of the trend in the bond market, which is to say there's bargain hunters, quote unquote bargain hunters, who are stepping right back into the bond market because now things are so much more attractive. Instead of a German 10-year bond yielding 6 basis points and virtually everything out to 8 years being in a negative rate, now things are yielding closer to 0.5% or 0.75%. And isn't that a bargain? So what's interesting is that's what we define bargain hunting by today, is still what is categorically insane behavior. And, you know, the Bloomberg article I'm referencing says this as well. The sharp moves have been exacerbated by a lack of liquidity as traditional dealers withdraw from the market to comply with stricter rules. Mm-hmm. The Institute of International Finance said this week that thin liquidity had become the top issue in talks with central banks and regulators.
Isn't that interesting timing, Dave? Because last week's show, that's what we were focusing on. Actually, it was a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Where we talked about there not being liquidity in the market when you need it.
What I thought was fascinating is this final quote from the Institute of International Finance. It said the new rules amounted to a dramatic revolution that had re-engineered the global financial system and pushed risk out into the shadows, storing up outcomes that are likely to be pretty painful and certainly unknowable. I appreciated the candor in a Bloomberg article looking at what had, in their words, degenerated into a momentum trade, which basically, when you are talking about a momentum trade, you're talking about something that has degenerated away from fundamentals and away from real reasons to own, and now is just, you're doing it because everybody's doing it, kind of like a high school popularity contest.
And you normally see that in a rising stock market or Beanie Babies, okay? Let's face it, when you see everybody else buying them, and it's like, you're kidding me, that Beanie Baby is worth $400. Give me three, you know? Well, there's not a lot of liquidity in the Beanie Baby market. And what's interesting, though, is there's not a lot of liquidity in this gigantic thing we call the bond market. Now, let's talk about why interest rates would rise, okay? There's a increased risk of default. That's one reason interest rates rise. The other, Dave, is ominous, because with all this money that's been printed, interest rates rise also because of expectation of inflation.
Well, that's true. Now, granted, they're targeting inflation, so expecting it and seeing interest rates rise, they'd actually like to see it happen.
Right.
And they realize that it needs to happen, and it hasn't happened quite yet.
But even the 2% target, Dave, you're talking about halving your money about every 28 years. You know, a lot of people don't realize the slow creep, why their dollar buys less and less, even with 2% inflation being a target.
Yep. Well, New Zealand popularized was the idea of having an inflation target at all. And that goes back 25 or 30 years ago. And now you have folks at MIT and the IMF suggesting that the 2% number, while it's an interesting number, is not all that scientific. In fact, it could be as high as 4%, and that would be good for economic growth as well. And I'm thinking to myself, 4%? 4% is devastating to a saver. If you are having your pocket picked to the tune of 4% every year via inflation, and then as we suggested last week, as Ken Rogoff has suggested, perhaps we do away with paper money altogether so that we can apply financial repression to the entire stock of money. It strikes me as odd to maintain this system of Ponzi finance. We have to increase a certain base level of taxation, but do it very surreptitiously. You know, you could call it a stealth inflation. You could call it anything you want, but it's ultimately getting in our pockets.
Well, and let's just look at the math on that. Okay, let's say that there's a 50-year-old person listening to this show right now with the plans of retiring about age 64, 14 years later. They would have to save at 4% inflation, just being a normal target. That person would have to save twice what they're spending now or what they planned on saving, because their money would buy half. If you've got 4% inflation, that's 14 years before your money is worth half of what it is today. Well, speaking of people in their 50s, Dave, the jobs numbers took my breath away, because it looks like in this country anyway, no one's really getting a job in normal working years. It's the people who are in their 50s and their 60s right now that are making up for all the jobs virtually, and there are also part-time jobs, not full-time jobs.
Right. Just in a nutshell, your non-farm payrolls, these are your jobs numbers out this last week. The March figures were revised lower by 32%. That was a pretty big hit, because it was an ugly number to begin with, and it got uglier. The April numbers, the non-farm payrolls, those were increased by 223,000. And what's interesting is this, because we have this strange market psychology where that actually, as you got into the details of the number, it was a very negative report, which ended up being very positive for the stock market. The worse it is, the less likely the Fed is going to do anything.
Bad news is good news to the stock market
exactly.
these days.
And of course, good news is good news as well. So we have a one-way bet in the stock market. Well, why do we say things weren't exactly rosy there? 223, decent number. And if you're averaging 200, you really have nothing to complain about. But as you mentioned, the big gains came in the 55 and older segments. You had full-time jobs, which actually declined by 252,000. So full-time jobs are down. Part-time workers increased 437,000. Part-timers for non-economic reasons were up 323,000. Then factor in, if you will, the birth-death modeling. This is statistic anomaly. These are not real jobs created. Nevertheless, we pencil in 213,000 jobs from the birth-death modeling. You've got an increase in the not in the labor force numbers to an all-time high, taking us back to the days of Jimmy Carter, 1977, 93.194 million people who are not in the labor force. So let's just summarize all that. To summarize the health of the jobs market, and really by means of encouragement to those who are now graduating from college, the jobs were all part-time. The jobs all went to workers 55 and older. Mm-hmm. And, well, I think that just about summarizes it.
So what you have is you have an increase in part-time jobs. What they are people who are looking towards retirement but having to go back to work, and they're getting a part-time swing shift at Starbucks. That's really what's happening. They're becoming baristas.
Well, and then you've got what Janet Yellen likes as one of her favorite indicators, also relating to jobs, although it's just job openings, not actually people hired. And it's what is known as the JOLTS, or job opening data. And this was brought to our attention by Bill King of the King Report. It seems that when the government is seeking bids on a contract, there will, of course, be a variety of bids, many bids. Mm-hmm. But curiously, the JOLT figures count all the posted openings from all the bidders, and not just the bid that's accepted. So, for instance, a contract that will ultimately employ 80 to 100 people will indicate 1,800 to 3,000 job openings because of the multiple bids and the people that they will need to hire if they get the bid.
Well, that makes no sense, but Janet Yellen likes to use this number?
Well, of course. Through the Yellen lens, you've got 1,800 to 3,000 job openings, which are viewed as a positive economic indicator. And I'm just thinking to myself, it's a good thing she only runs the central bank and not something more important. You know, we can all rest easy knowing that the tough decisions are being made on the basis of hard data.
Well, what if you, as a person who runs a company, Dave, what if you counted every inquiry as a sale? You just use that as a bottom line. Well, that would be very, very positive, would it not?
Well, and then on that basis, went out and got a lot of small business loans to increase the size of our business because our sales were so good.
Based on inquiry.
That's exactly right.
Right.
So this strange, incestuous relationship between the Fed and the Treasury, their information gathering, their decision making, and then the debt that we accrue. I mean, quite frankly, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the insanity you see in Japan today, where you have an improvement in GDP statistics by dropping the deflator to a negative number.
And the deflator is how they count their inflation, basically.
That's right. Yeah. So when you're looking at GDP, which is, of course, the total scale of the Japanese economy or any economy, you have to factor out how much growth has come from just inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this component which subtracts out the inflation addition. They call it the deflator. If you make the deflator a negative number, you end up boosting artificially your GDP statistic. And now the Japanese are patting themselves on the back for an improvement in actually saying, look, GDP is now growing. Abenomics and this three-prong approach to growth is actually working. And they've gotten so close to the numbers that they've forgotten how much is just actual BS.
Well, what we're talking about so far, Dave, are just bureaucrats. This is how bureaucrats count prosperity. And unfortunately for us, they don't really need to prove out. They don't have to meet a bottom line because they can just print money. The type of person who has to meet a bottom line has to look at indicators that are true so that they can make good predictions. Now, I'm thinking Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett isn't perfect, obviously, but he's developed a reputation of finding value. And one of his key indicators that he likes to look at is the capitalization of the stock market relative to GDP, relative to the economy.
So if you put Buffett on the back of a napkin, this is what you get. He just says, how do I do sort of a thumbnail appraisal, a real simple sketch of the stock market being too expensive or cheap on the other side of things? And what he draws from is the Federal Reserve quarterly Z1 balance sheet. And he takes that number and divides it by the current size of the economy. So essentially, as your numerator, you've got the value of all equities.
Right.
And then you're taking nominal quarterly GDP as the denominator. So you're dividing $22.5 trillion, which is the current estimated value of all stocks according to the Federal Reserve, dividing that by GDP, mm-hmm. and you end up with a particular number. Today, it's about 132% of GDP. Well, what does that mean exactly? How does it fit in? The highest ever recorded was in the year 2000.
At the top of the tech stock bubble.
And that was 153% of GDP. GDP.
And it's 132 right now?
We're now 132, which again, if you're looking at sort of standard deviations, we are at 2.5 standard deviations from the mean. The highest ever has been a 3 standard deviation. We know that overvaluation, and we do have that today, can last a long time. It can go further than expected, but this bull market began from a very different level than what you would consider sort of normal to begin with. So bull markets typically, using this Buffett back of the napkin indicator, bull markets typically start out at around 32 to 35% of GDP and work their way up towards excess, which would be above 100%. Now we're 132%. In fact, if you go back in time and look at this relative, say, 1968, or wanted to speculate as to what it would be back in 1929 or 1907 or some of these early stock market booms, what you would find is that it never got to more than about 80 to 100%.
Hmm.
So these two periods in modern history, now and the year 2000, stand out. They're totally different than any other thing in financial market history. And a part of it is because we've brought in a tremendous amount of leverage into the financial system. We've seen the financialization of the economy, which has exaggerated the numbers in a fairly dramatic way.
Well, talking about dramatic, you know, we had talked last week about the old adage, sell in May. Okay, that period of time from May up until you get to about November in the stock market. And what were the figures? I think $10,000 turned into over $800,000. $100,000 if you had just taken money and put it in the late fall and taken it out in the late spring.
November to April were your winning months. Well, just like you have a winning season, there's also winning years. Mm. And Doug Short lays out an interesting comparison of bull versus bear markets and tallies the years spent in one trend or the other. If you go back to 1877, it's about a 60-40 split. And that is sort of 80 years of growth, 52 years of contraction. And again, you can look at the seasons of growth, but there are blocks of time where you are just on the wrong side of the trend or on the right side of the trend. 80 years of growth, 52 years of contraction puts it at a 60-40 split.
About half or a little bit better than half the time the market's going down. And so you don't necessarily want to ride through all the bulls and the bears. I mean, you need to recognize the cycle.
You would navigate it differently and certainly on a more defensive basis if you recognize that you are at a market peak and moving into a period of subpar growth.
So we talk about growth in the stock market, but how does inflation factor into that?
Doug Short also draws an interesting graph which looks at the S&P 500. 500 largest companies in the country, and charts from 1870 to the present and shows its long-term trend using an inflation-adjusted regression. And current readings are well above trend. In fact, the latest price puts the market 93% above trend, which is the second highest level in U.S. stock market history. So is the stock market a bargain? No. Can it go higher? Well, stranger things have occurred. And we would suggest that if the stock market does move higher, if at all, it'll be short-lived, followed by several years of sharp losses. That brings us to, frankly, one of my favorite long-term measures, which also ties into that same Federal Reserve reported data. That is the quarterly Z1 statistics from the Federal Reserve balance sheet.
Well, Andrew Smithers has looked at what's called the Q ratio and really has focused on that. He's been a guest of ours on the show. It's been a very accurate indicator as to the true valuation of the stock market. Would you bring up again that Q ratio because it's so important?
Yeah, well, the Q ratio goes back to Dr. Tobin, and he was professor of economics at Yale for 38 years, winner of the Nobel Prize in economics. And this was one of his fascinating little projects in which, again, he's trying to figure out how to value a company and determine when something is overvalued or undervalued. And Q, or the Tobin ratio, compares the current traded price of a company or the stock market as a whole to the hard assets of those companies.
So plant and equipment, that type of thing.
Well, exactly. You're talking about the replacement cost of a business. If you had to go out and in today's dollars buy and pour concrete, if you had to buy land and put in a road and infrastructure to build a plant. So yes, land, plant, infrastructure. And what you're looking for as an investor is premiums or discounts. Like with any value proposition, the premiums are seen when you have inflated markets and represent good times to be liquidating those assets, not buying them. And the discounts represent bargains and suggest to someone who's a value-oriented buyer that it's cheaper to buy an existing set of assets at a discount than to create the business from scratch and pay the replacement costs for the business.
Well, let's do an analogy here then, because for those who don't own a business, let's just compare it to most people own a home.
Well, I mean, then this may be a little high depending on what part of the country you live in, but let's say your costs to build a single family home are $250 a square foot. That'll build you a very nice home. $250 a square foot. And if that's the going rate, imagine stepping into the market, buying a used home, not for the $250 that you could build one, but for $325. Would you feel like you were paying a little too much? Would you feel like you're paying above the market for it?
Sounds like New York right now.
And there you'll find it's probably closer to $1,000 or $1,200 a square foot. But, you know, on average, again, the difference between the replacement cost of $250 and the premium you could pay of $325. Now, let's go to the value side of things. Let's say that you're paying $165 a square foot for something that you know if you had to build it today, you couldn't do it for anything less than $250 a square foot.
So that's your deal.
That's a good deal. Yeah. So the Q ratio is the same mindset applied to equities. And the current levels of Tobin's Q, and again, this isn't a new concept. It was, as I mentioned, developed by Dr. Tobin while he was teaching at Yale. And what do we see there? The current levels of Tobin's Q are higher than all the market peaks 1907, 1929, 1937, 1968, 2007. The outlier is the year 2000.
And that was, again, the tech stock bubble. Everything was out of proportion.
Exactly.
Back then.
Where valuations were so wacky that nothing else in financial history compares. Well, look back to it. I mean, you had Pets.com selling for better than 500 years worth of non-existent earnings. Is it any surprise that this outlier in terms of a valuation spike on a chart is there in the year 2000? Pets.com. Okay. So, yes, it was wacky, but what we're suggesting is that today is only one notch off. Today's levels are the highest in history, setting aside that one anomaly. The ratio swings just like any price in the market. You have high ratios, you have low ratios, and it's a very helpful way, using Tobin's Q, of gauging where you're at. Are you above or below an average trading range? And, you know, 50-60% above the average level represents the typical peak. And quite symmetrically, 50-60% below the average represents the typical low ebb in the market. Again, those two curious anomalies were 2000 with the extraordinary high peak, more than two times any other in history, and the discount in 2009, which I think is very fascinating and worth talking about. Because typically, if the discount to an average is 50-60%, we got to about a third of that, which suggested for us, stocks even in 2009 were not a very good value. And typically, at the end of a bear market, you have a bloodied and beaten investor base, and they have already thrown in the towel. And this goes back to like 1981, when Time magazine and other magazines were announcing the death of equities. In other words, there was no one interested in owning them, and you could pick things up for pennies on the dollar. We did not see those kinds of values in the corrective phase in 2008 and 2009. The correction only went about a third the distance that it should have, in line with Tobin's Q in the past.
Well, one of the things that Smithers has brought out as well is, you know, for the person who's addicted to day trading their portfolio based on the speed of the internet these days, the Q ratio really is not much of a help, is it? It's not a short-term timing tool. It is a long-term valuation tool.
Well, that's correct. It's not a timing tool at all. It's most useful to the long-term investor who's asking the question, where will I be in 5 to 10 years? And what kinds of returns can I expect between now and then? To which Tobin's Q suggests, at this point, your returns are likely to be marginally positive, maybe 1%, 2% each year on average. So you're taking a lot of risk with very little reward on offer if you're looking at your average returns over the next 10 to 15 years. To me, that's not compelling. But some also would argue that Smithers is too conservative an investor. Look, he moved largely to cash over a year ago and could certainly be criticized for missing the upside, so to say. But I guess for me, I would remind you that the last year has also seen many professionals join that on the sidelines category.
Well, we just brought that up. You got back from New York 3 weeks ago, and the meeting of the minds of the billionaires, there was a lot of cash position at that point, wasn't there?
Well, right. These are folks that I think as professionals get it. And they've done the same thing as Smithers did over a year ago. Now, maybe it's cash levels of 25%, 50%, 65%. Very rarely we'll find somebody who's moved 100% to cash. Of course, my confidence is in ounces. That is cash to me. Gold and cash are synonymous in my book, and I'm heavily weighted there. But whether it's greenbacks or gold ounces, the case against owning equities remains a significant one.
You know, Dave, this week we had a valued client of ours send a report from Fisher, who writes for Forbes, and he would disagree. Fisher would disagree. And our client just wanted to hear what your comments were on that report. And, you know, the report was very, very optimistic about the economy, almost pushing aside any thought of risk whatsoever. I really appreciated the response that you gave to that. Would you just give us some of the points after reading Fisher's report, 14-page report, on why you should be buying stocks right now, not selling?
Well, I think generally speaking, you can categorize the bulls and the bears as those who are either fixated on risk or fixated on reward. The bulls being fixated on the reward, the bears being fixated on risk. And I think maybe that's even not a fair assessment, because you've got plenty of bulls who are conscientious about risks and are in fact somewhat paranoid about risks.
You can be a careful bull.
And I think that's what was lacking in this appraisal, 14 pages entirely dismissive of risks. And I quote the money manager explaining, most risks today are either false or too small and widely discussed to move stocks materially.
I know that made you twitch. I could see it as you read it. So,
I mean, again, it immediately brings to mind, you remember Larry Ellison, Oracle CEO, many attempts with his yachting team. He put together a yachting syndicate to sort of smash all the records in terms of the competitions for yachting. And his boats have been so effective at capturing the power of the wind that at times they do it too effectively and they get flipped, they get destroyed, people can get hurt. The natural forces of wind and wave actually are greater than the stability of his fiberglass yachts. Very expensive, by the way. And it's the scenario where it's always impressive until his crew is in the water testing their life vests again.
Right.
And then it's a little less impressive. So it's surprising to me that risks are so thoroughly and comprehensively dismissed. And by the way, this is one money manager, but I think it typifies the consensus view, which is, look, you're arguing with 5 years of momentum. And I want to go back to that Bloomberg article, which said of the bond market, we have degenerated into a momentum trade.
But that was to the downside.
Well, and I think we've degenerated into a momentum trade in the equity markets as well as the bond markets.
Well, one of the points that he made in this report was he's looking for double-digit returns in the global equity markets. Now, what's your thought on that?
Okay, non-US, global, or all-encompassing. The global equity markets, if they're going to see double-digit gains this year, with the second half of the year sort of having the surprise to the upside. Again, I recall from our conversation last week that the May to October period is statistically like a windless day at sea. It's not great if you're sailing. And then you remember Newman's comments on that point. Again, we're talking about the dead period. So I guess we're supposed to see a double-digit rate of return accrue sometime between November and December, and thus close out the year on a high note. I think that's rather optimistic.
So you're skeptical.
Well, my other response is that global economic growth and developing world equity markets are dependent on excess liquidity from the developed world. This is where their growth comes from. If you're going to see equity markets overseas do well, again, it's a spillover effect from liquidity in the developed markets. The U.S. is now running smaller and smaller trade deficits, which shrinks the liquidity previously depended on to fuel growth overseas. So this is a strike against the growth thesis.
That's what Malmgren called the perfect circle, is us running a deficit and creating liquidity overseas.
Well, that's right. And this has already affected Asian countries. You can see it in shrinking trade surpluses from their manufactured goods. And the effects are equally felt in the Middle East. There's less revenue from U.S. oil purchases. This is very critical because think about how that affects our ability to finance our spending deficits, which, if you recall, the nature of petrodollar recycling, it puts more pressure on the Fed to monetize treasury debt and allow, can we call them, the gentle people of D.C. to continue sort of their slop fest in the pig trough.
So what you would say is the growth thesis in the global equity markets over the next 6 months or so is probably not going to pan out.
Well, we have contracting liquidity, not increasing liquidity. So how does the developing world contribute to sort of this global market growth and double-digit gains if, in fact, we're in an environment of shrinking liquidity? And then there is the central bank liquidity. So we've got trade liquidity. Now you've got central bank liquidity, which has not found a way out of the financial sector and has therefore not become an economic driver, if you will, a driver of economic activity.
It's driven the stock market, but it's not driving the economy.
Right, right. And this has occurred neither in the developed or developing world. So the two forms or sources of liquidity, they remain absent. You've got China, which has dropped their rates for a third time in 6 months.
Just looking to stimulate.
Of course. And so we do have a free for all in Shanghai and the Hong Kong markets, and that's set to continue. But for how long? To what extent? It's just curious to me. It's now ingrained amongst the leveraged and speculative community that central bank monetary policy is in essence paving a new way into a new kind of capitalism. And this is apparently a good thing. I guess I have to register my doubts on that.
Well, one of the things that Fisher said was, get ready because we're setting up for a second half surprise in the U.S. equity market, the stock market. What's your thought on the surprise?
We tend to agree, although we might disagree with the direction of the surprise.
Oh, he thinks up, you think down.
Right. So valuations remain an issue of concern. We talked about that earlier. You've got low levels of retail investor cash. You have low levels of mutual fund cash. You have very high levels of retail investor margin debt, in aggregate $474 billion worth of margin debt. You have an adjustment to higher rates, which still has to be accommodated. And you have markets which are pricing in as a discount, zero rate money. So any adjustment to the interest rates will affect all asset classes in question. I mean, we could go on and on. There are many other factors that, in essence, hang like the sword of Damocles over the market.
Well, Fisher did say, though, initial interest rate hikes are probably not going to be enough to affect the market to the downside.
And again, I felt like, as I was reading the report, that's fair, but it's unfair, because for the novice investor or for the trusting investor in the Fisher management scheme, you know what you have? You have something that's absolutely true. The first rate hike doesn't do much. Again, it's the impact on the equity markets from the second and third, which is much more significant. And that was the point that Edson Gould, who was the famous Wall Street technician of the 60s and 70s, made. He said, three hikes and a tumble. Three hikes and a tumble. And so, you know, Fisher's basically saying, don't worry about an interest rate raise. Well, that's true to some degree. But if it's more than 25 basis points and they do it more than once, all of a sudden you have an aggregate effect, which may very well cause a recalibration of investors. And we talked about that weeks ago or months ago, dealing with discounted cash flow models that many analysts use. What's the value of a company using a discounted cash flow model? You're using interest rates as a part of the equation. And with zero bound interest rates, you have inflated stock prices. Now introduce a more realistic interest rate, and what happens to stock prices?
Yeah, zero interest rates are the best of all worlds. You've already valued in something that can't really get any better as far as cheap money. But I want to go back to the quote that he talked about, because you've outlined a number of risks. Risks that some of these money managers are saying are just too high, so they've moved to cash. But Fisher says, and I quote, and you quoted this earlier, most risks today are either false or too small and widely discussed to move stocks materially.
And what he's getting at is that if we know the risks, we can't be surprised by the risks, and they're already factored into the price. So, right. You know, using the efficient market hypothesis, we have the prices reflecting all known reality, good, bad, and everything else. And I think to myself, that sums up the entire 14 pages. Again, it's just dismissive of all possible risks. Look at Bear Stearns. Their first loss was only $400 million.
Now, I remember when that happened. Was that 07 when they put it out there and then they pulled it back off the market because they didn't want to scare anybody?
Two hedge funds that were running into trouble, and, you know, they were too small, frankly, to move the stock materially. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we live in a world where Bear Stearns doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
But people seem to forget that crisis dynamics take one issue and multiply it. It multiplies it 10 times. It multiplies it 100 times. And the ways that Wall Street measures risk using value at risk modeling doesn't account for this.
Well, and I think we're forgetting something here, Dave. We're talking about markets that are being fully stimulated by the easiest central bank policy in the history of mankind. Let's say the central banks weren't doing any of this quantitative easing, zero interest rate policy, any of those things. The markets would still be at risk. Yet the markets are underperforming or sort of performing, yet we have trillions and trillions that have come in. I mean, let's face it, in the last 4 years, 5 years, we've gone from $8 trillion to $18 trillion in debt, and the Federal Reserve's added $4 trillion just to its account.
I want to qualify that, though, because it's not a new experiment. It's just new by its universal application. In other words, it's now ubiquitous. You've got central banks all around the world playing by the same sheet music. And so the singular reality globally remains that the markets globally are 100% dependent on central bank promises. And we may want to normalize that. We may want to normalize rates. We may want to get back to a more rules-based type monetary policy. But if the attempts to normalize are delayed, the distortions created will carry far graver consequences in the end. And again, it remains to be seen if we can normalize and take the pain. We wonder if the markets or the people who are pulling the puppet strings for the markets, if they can take the pain.
You know, when you were talking to Pippa Malmgren, you used an analogy of keeping a basketball below the surface if you're in a swimming pool. And the further you push it down and the longer you hold it, the more likely you're going to have a opposite reaction. So what you're talking about is if the central banks continue to stimulate the way they are, and the markets continue to eat that up and continue to grow, especially the equities market, then the reaction to the other side, I mean, talk about a momentum trade, a degenerating momentum trade to the downside. It'll be startling.
It's the difference in information. The central bank believes that they have information which tells them very clearly what the rate of interest should be, what the cost of capital should be. And Knut Wicksell would have asked the question, well, what is the natural rate? Not the rate when you're standing on top of it, like holding down that ball underneath the water, but what is the natural rate?
Let that baby float. Let's just see where it floats.
I think whether it's Fisher or others who sort of define the consensus view, the burden of proof is on the bulls to explain why monetary policy remains more accommodative than at any other time in global financial history, with a very embarrassing level of growth to show for it. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, as I think about these things, you were talking about the deflator in Japan. We're talking about these various rates that academics use. I have to remember back to this last Super Bowl and the playoffs that got the Patriots to the Super Bowl. And now we have something called Deflategate. So, you know, it's interesting how everyone seems at this point that they can play by changed rules, but there are consequences.
You know, it's interesting. This all will work well and work brilliantly until some unforeseen shock or black swan takes us by surprise. And at that moment, there'll be a whole host of investors and people marched on to Bloomberg and CNBC who will say, we didn't see it coming. It was utterly fantastic and outside of every potential mathematical model. And I'm just, you know what I'm going to remember? Kevin, I'm going to remember this quote, which again, that ignored the facts that are categorized today as risks which are either false, too small, or widely discussed to move markets materially. Because I think, frankly, it's one of those risks which will be the undoing of the market.
So, Dave, it may sound like a broken record, but sometimes you have to have a broken record approach if you're going to stay safe. And so I want you to restate what exactly you would recommend people do right now with their money. What market should they be jumping into? What market should they be jumping out of? Or should they just stay cash liquid in cash, gold, silver, what have you? Just give us an example of what a portfolio should look like right now.
It remains to be seen whether central banks have exhausted all of their efforts in terms of desperately controlling the financial markets. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that this move higher in interest rates is short-lived and we see rates return to rock-bottom prices again. I don't know that that's something I want to speculate on. I think ultimately this is as dangerous as playing with Latin American bonds in the last 100 years, where rates moved lower because of a perception of risk, and thus rates moved lower and bond prices moved higher. But ultimately, it became unsustainable and governments stepped on the rates and forced them down even lower. The ultimate break comes when confidence is questioned and stability is reappraised, and you generally see a spike in rates. We have a spike in rates right now. The question is, does it carry forward to 2, 3, 4% instead of just moving in fractions of a percent as it has in the last few weeks? Having said all that, I'm just not comfortable owning bonds. So I would be very, very cautious in the bonds that you own. If you do choose to own fixed income instruments, keep them very short term in duration, and that gives you some protection. So a short-term laddered portfolio would certainly give you all the protection that you need if you're going to maintain an allocation to fixed income.
How about equities, U.S. equities, global equities?
I think when you see the markets trip, you're going to see them fall in tandem. It's not going to be sort of a great differentiator being in, you know, the Turkish stock market or the German stock market or the Brazilian or Mexican stock market as opposed to or instead of, you know, a more developed market like the New York Stock Exchange. I think, as we discussed earlier, from a valuation standpoint, we are pushing the envelope in terms of the extreme nature of stocks and their current prices. doesn't mean that they can't go higher. And if the central bank redoubles its effort and is willing to print trillions more, the knee-jerk reaction will to see the stock market go even higher. And that ultimately is okay with me, because those are not levels that can be sustained. What I would look for as an investor is that 5 to 10 year time horizon, asking the question, buying today and holding as an investor classically would, for a longer time frame, have I bought well? Did I buy right? And I think you would have to say today and tomorrow, you're not buying well, you're not buying right. So equities today, if you can hedge them, hedge them. If you're going to keep them in your portfolio, make sure you've covered some of the downside by hedging those positions as effectively as possible. Or, you know, better yet, would be Andrew Smithers' advice, which is begin to sell your equities and sit in cash. He likes cash and he likes it a lot. I know a lot of people that like it a lot because they don't understand the complications of owning gold. What they don't understand is that gold ownership is actually not that complicated. And so some balance for me personally between cash, actual cash, and gold and silver makes a lot of sense. So certainly you can maintain positions in other asset classes, but you should be defensive in terms of protecting from downside volatility. Otherwise, just get out. And if you are going to get out, then a balance between Federal Reserve notes and some measure of protection against the mismanagement of those Federal Reserve notes by the Federal Reserve, I think is warranted. It's pretty simple, but I think this is a period in time where simple, following the KISS principle, is probably as good as the back of the napkin indicator that Buffett gave you. Again, it's just kind of a rough thumbnail sketch of what's too much and what's not enough. I think if you took a back of the napkin approach to investing and simplified and had that as an operative principle, you'd do much better over the next few years.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call anytime at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.